Planned Parenthood, would you have imagined that you would have heard a comment like that? I don't know. You probably don't realize, but there are probably very few pastors in the entire country this Sunday that said defund Planned Parenthood, right? You know, I mean, if you appreciate Pastor Graham for his clear stand on issues, you know, whether we deserve to send $528 million of our tax dollars to an organization that every year aborts over 300,000 babies and now has been trafficking in body parts. That alone is worth some of the conversation that we're going to have today. And I thought, again, maybe we can send a word of thanks to the pastor for his boldness, because I really appreciate that. That is very unusual, I'll have to know. I've traveled in a lot of churches and can't imagine hearing some of those kinds of comments there. And he also kind of changed my mind. Now, next week I had kind of something planned, but with Johnny Moore here. Some of you might remember Johnny Moore because I gave you the CD of the interview that I've done with him. If not, I'll bring some more next week, okay? But he will be here with us in the sanctuary, and since he'll be talking about ISIS and the refugees and things like that, maybe I'll try to do something that parallels that. It's always good to have something in the second hour that parallels what you'll hear in the first hour. And for those of you that have been associated with us at Point of View, we actually raise funds for the organization that he helped establish, which is called the Cradle Fund, which is to actually minister to believers who are refugees, those who have been driven from their homes by ISIS and are now in these refugee camps. And we felt there might be a need to do something for that. And after he was on our program a while back, we were so convicted that we said every donation given to Point of View for the Cradle Fund will give right over there. And at first we sent a check for $35,000. Now it's up to $50,000. Money just still keeps coming in. And this is a wonderful organization that is headed up by a Southern Baptist, interestingly enough, who has very strong connections with the international community. And the money is put in the hands of the churches so that the churches get to actually minister to those individuals in those refugee camps. And can imagine if today we had a marauding army coming in and you had to escape with the clothes on your back. And imagine then you would have to live through the heat of Texas summer or the cold of Texas winter. This is what these people have been going through. So anyway, Johnny Moore is going to have a lot to say about that next week. And since Pastor Graham and Johnny Moore kind of changed my topic, is that okay with everybody? That's kind of what I was thinking. We could kind of get into some of that and tell you maybe some of the backstory that you won't have a chance to tell you. And we'll bring maybe some more of those CDs of the interview I did with him. Actually, I've done two interviews with him now. And certainly just an outstanding individual. By the way, he used to be the chaplain for Liberty University. And for many years was the individual that ministered to all the students. And then, as he was interesting enough writing a book that I had him on about how to know God's will, he applied it to his own life, and now he works with Mark Burnett and Roma Downey in all those films. And so it's really nice to have somebody with really good orthodox biblical belief looking at those films and evaluating some of those. So anyway, that's just a little bit of the backstory. Is that okay with you? Today we're going to look at responding to the book of Revelation, and it relates to my attempt to, first of all, recognize that we're coming to the end of that series. Hasn't that been a great series? Chapter 22. We saw the last chapter. We know who wins. But in the midst of this, a lot of people are asking questions about how do I respond? You know, some were saying, for example, if some of these Ask Kirby things, you know, how do we respond to the Supreme Court decision coming down? What about how does this relate to the issue of prophecy? I mean, if we know the end is coming, you know, should we get politically involved? I have one here that says, do you know what the Jade Helm is all about? Well, I'll try to get to that today. What about the monetary crisis, you know, that might be befalling America and certainly is happening in Greece? So I tried to figure out a way to put all of that together. Now, as you probably figured out now, if you thought the pastor was political, I'm going to be political, okay? It's going to get a little political today. Now, that being said, that doesn't mean that everybody has to agree with everything I've said. There are times when we talk about issues where I think we all have to be on the same page, justification by faith. You know, if you don't believe in justification by faith, you're either going to have to believe it or you probably can't be a member of this church, okay? There are other issues where Christians could honestly disagree about this. And another point I want to make before we get into this is also, as we go through this, I think there are going to be different ways in which Christians respond. There's not a one-size-fits-all. As we're going to see, you know, certainly the book of Revelation reminds us, and we've been going through this now for months, about the end times. And I think almost everybody everybody in this room believes we're in the end time. So how do we think about that? And in light of the recent Supreme Court decision, for example, or even Planned Parenthood, as was brought up today by some of the individuals, you know, what do we do? And there have been a lot of Christians that said maybe it's just time to withdraw from the conflict. We're not going to win. This is not going to be a place where we should put our time and energy. And so maybe we should withdraw and retreat. And some of you might say, well, that's kind of what I think I need to do. You know, I'm just not a politically involved person. And, you know, we'll leave that to some of the people in the church that are politically involved. You know, you have Scott Turner and you have Ron Simmons and you have Jeff Leach, and you have Ken Paxton, you have just a couple others, you know, that are all part of the political involvement. But that's not what I do. So I understand that, first of all, that's a possibility for some of us. And so that's one idea. But then some have said, well, you know, this is going to get really bad, so we've got to prepare for the apocalypse. And so since I got some questions about preppers, okay, we're going to talk about that today. What about that issue? And then finally, what about this idea of continuing our cultural engagement? And so we're going to look at each one of those and try to hopefully cover this quickly. And if we have time, Parker can grab the microphone. You can ask some questions. And if you want to disagree or shout me down or anything, I'm used to this. I've been on college campuses and I have difficulty there. But let's talk about this issue of withdraw and retreat, because I really think it's important for Christians to begin to think about this. And I'll start with David Brooks. He is kind of the lone conservative in the New York Times. And he talked about this being the next culture war and began to talk about the need for us maybe to disengage from the culture war. And so Robert Knight, who's been on my program recently, wrote a piece that was in the Washington Times, said, right on cue, following the Supreme Court's demolition of marriage, conservative David Brooks said it's time to move on and leave cultural issues in the dust. But first of all, Robert Knight says that he accurately does diagnose the situation. And that is, David Brooks, in his piece in the New York Times, says more and more Christians feel estranged from the mainstream culture. They feel that they will soon be treated as social pariahs. You starting to feel like that a little bit? I think so. Some heads are shaking up there. They feel their colleges will be decertified. Their religious institutions will lose their tax-exempt status. Their religious liberty will come under greater assault. And so I think he has a good diagnosis. Why is it that some of us are saying maybe it's just time to just pull back? And if indeed that is the case, you can understand why we would have that field. And so he goes on to say, consider putting aside in the current climate the culture war around the sexual revolution. Now, he was focusing primarily, I suspect, on the issue of homosexuality. But let's be honest for just a minute. Apart from our pastor, and maybe apart from, say, Robert Jeffers at First Baptist, who fears neither man nor God. I mean, he goes on every talk show I've ever seen in the country. I mean, he's just as bold as I've ever seen. And, you know, many others. So, I mean, it's not a small list, but it is a minority list for sure. But apart from those individuals, how many pastors even address something related to the sexual revolution? You think about this. When's the last time, if you've been in other churches, or even think about even our own church, that you've heard a message on cohabitation, living together, or on, you know, same-sex marriage? Well, maybe here you have. Maybe a message on the issue of divorce. I mean, a lot of these issues all related to this have completely faded away. And so in some respects, what he is saying is that let's just face the reality. Churches really aren't even speaking to these issues that much anymore. And after this decision, how many pastors are going to stand in the pulpit and preach on Romans 1 or other passages like that? So something to think about. But Robert Knight, I think, had a very good response. He said, in other words, leave the public square to radicals who are creating a government and culture openly hostile to anyone with traditional values. It's a good question to ask. He says they might believe that maybe they won't hit you if you keep your head down. In other words, if you just kind of keep your head down, don't look up, and don't cause any problems, that's the case. But Robert Knight has a great response. He says, you know, taking leave as outsiders might have made sense in an authoritarian regime like ancient Rome. But America was created as a self-governing republic where we are Caesar. The reality is for some believers around the country right now, we have individuals that go, for example, to Myanmar, which is used to be called Burma. Well, it's really tough to be a Christian there right now. Really tough. And really, you just either obey the government or you disobey the government if it commands you to do something wrong. But you really have no choice. You go to places like China. Many of our people have gone and worked with the underground church in China. We don't publicize that a whole lot, but we do. Again, you only have a few choices there. But in this country, guess who the Caesar is? It's not the Politburo. It's not a king. It's not a dictator. It's what? We the people. And there's another way to think about this. If you look at it this way, what does Romans 13, 1 to 7 say? Well, first of all, we are to obey government. Why? Because government is ordained by God. So we are to obey government. But if we aren't involved in any kind of political activity, then it means that secular politicians make the laws that we as Christians must obey. Does that make any sense? I think it is really good. I forgot Matt Shaheen's name just a minute ago, but there's one more name to put in that long list of individuals, even in our own church, that are actually working in Austin or in other places, some that are members of Congress in Washington, to actually make sure that the laws we live under at least make some room for Christian conviction. And so that's kind of why lots of people have said maybe the idea of leaving the culture war, maybe for some that makes sense. You know, I'm not going to get involved in politics. You know, I'll vote every 4 years, but that's about all I'm going to do. I understand that. But at the same time, I want us to support those individuals who have felt a calling in the political realm to make a difference. There's another part of this that's kind of intriguing, and David French, who's been on my program before, and I've known him for quite a while, wrote this book, and here we thought we lost the war. In other words, he's saying, are we really losing? I mean, the argument is that we're losing the culture war, and he points out a couple of things. Three separate surveys that have come out since the Supreme Court decision, basically legalizing same-sex marriage, found that national support for same-sex marriage is declining. Three different polls show that. Now, his argument is a lot of that had to do with the gay bullies. You know, the individuals that have maybe reached too far and said too much and had the rainbow pictures on their Facebook page and called for all sorts of things. But nevertheless, as people started really thinking about this, interesting enough, points out that a very high majority of Americans think that government should not force somebody who is a florist, a photographer, a baker, or an innkeeper to actually participate in a same-sex marriage if it violates their religious convictions. So one of the questions he was asking is, are we really losing this? You know, the American people are still kind of with us. Just because five justices in the Supreme Court made the decision, does that mean that we're losing the culture war? Then he uses another example, and I couldn't have had a better connection, and that is Planned Parenthood, because he talked about the videos that have come out. And if you haven't seen those videos, first of all, I don't recommend you watch them over lunch, although these videos were taken as they were sitting over lunch. Nevertheless, we can see that there is a very cavalier attitude. Again, I can't imagine another church in the country that would have shown the piece by Britt Hume. Isn't that amazing? I met Britt Hume 41 years ago. At that time, I was vice president of the student body, and they asked me to interview one of the traveling speakers, and this man, Britt Hume, who at that time worked with Jack Anderson, was the speaker, so I had a chance to interview him and meet him 40 years ago. Back then, he was not a Christian, but because of his wife, he's become a Christian. Matter of fact, his wife, if you don't know, is one of the producers at Fox News, but that's another kind of inside the beltway kind of story. But nevertheless, you know, here, I thought it was really powerful what he had to say. But again, if you'd like to watch the videos, you can go to pointofview.net. We have posted them there. I don't recommend that you watch them while you're going to have lunch, even though almost all the interviews were done while they were having Caesar salad and sipping wine. But the American people's response has been dramatic, hasn't it been? Even people that call themselves, quote, pro-choice are looking for the high grass to run into because they don't want to endorse that. So that's another aspect of whether or not we should be involved in retreating from kind of the culture war. But Jonah Goldberg wrote a piece, this one appeared in the Los Angeles Times, but in other places as well, and it says, you can't compromise with culture warriors. And he talks about the fact that sometimes the response from a lot of Christians is, we will just give them that and they'll be satisfied. And the reality is, no, if you give them just that, they won't be appeased. And he uses a very interesting way to illustrate that. Right now, he is reading for his daughter the book, If You Give a Mouse a Cookie. Now, not that you all have read the book. So if you haven't, the story is pretty simple here. That is, if you give a mouse a cookie, then it wants a glass of milk. Then when you give it a glass of milk, it wants a straw, and then the whole story unfolds there. And the argument he's making is that when the Supreme Court gave, especially some of the gay bullies, a really big cookie, that is same-sex marriage, they didn't go, okay, we're done. Then they said, what next? And he points out in the column all sorts of things. Because within days after the Supreme Court decision, what did we see next? Well, we saw this article that was in Time magazine by Mark Oppenheimer. Now's the time to end tax exemptions for religious institutions. Now, though they have a picture there, he has actually suggested maybe they end the tax exemptions of other institutions as well. And one of those he mentions is Planned Parenthood, so my argument is you first. As a matter of fact, if they think about this for any length of time, I'm not sure they want to go down that road. Because he uses some examples of organizations that have tax exemption. Planned Parenthood, the ACLU. If an individual does not receive any kind of tax benefit from giving, do you think that those organizations are going to do very well? I don't think so. If this church lost its tax exemption, how many of you would say, okay, I'm going to stop giving to this church? You know, if we really believe in tithing, we'd like to get the benefit, but we would probably still give anyway, right? Another organization mentions the National Rifle Association. Do you really think that the NRA would just cease to exist if people who believe in the second... In other words, the groups that are going to be hurt by losing their tax-exempt status are going to be groups like what? Planned Parenthood, ACLU. But let's have that open discussion and really evaluate that, because one of the justifications for providing a tax exemption is what positive benefit do they give to the community? Well, boy, let's talk about all the positive benefit that Prestonwood Baptist Church gives to the community. We have, for example, the Bridge Builder backpacks right here, right? We got all those. We have, I just heard today, the Pregnancy Resource Center. You think of all the outreach, all the positive there. What benefit does Planned Parenthood give to the community other than aborting 300,000 children every single year? So, I mean, let's have the debate and really think it through for a little bit. But nevertheless, there's one example. As soon as that cookie came down, they said, hey, let's remove the tax-exempt status of some of those individuals. Shortly after the decision, you also had this come out in Politico. It's time to legalize polygamy, right? You know, we were told that when we would argue that if you legalize same-sex marriage, the next step would be polygamy. There would be people that would say, that is not the case. Joan Crowan just the other day was on Mark Davis' show. Oh, that's never going to happen. And look what we are dealing with. Every argument for redefining marriage and allowing same-sex marriage becomes an argument for redefining marriage and allowing multiple partners. And even the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court said, you know, occasionally in their argument, the individuals, the five justices, used the word two. Why does it have to stay two? And here you can see that as well. So one of the things we have to recognize is whether we pick this battle or not, whether we want this battle or not, standing for biblical marriage is going to be an important issue for us to at least deal with in terms of our friends, our neighbors, our coworkers, places where we have some kind of influence. Now, there have been some others that are now suggesting, and I just wanted to give this to you real quickly, what is called the Benedict option. It first was put forward by Alistair McIntyre, and although some of us at Probe read books by Alistair McIntyre, I do not recommend it for the faint-hearted. If you have any trouble sleeping, grab an Alistair McIntyre book, and it will put you to sleep very quickly. But because of his ideas, a more popular conservative writer, Rod Dreher, who writes for all sorts of different magazines, including Christianity Today, has promoted what is called the Benedict option, and that is that he thinks what we should begin to do in the midst of a hostile culture is carve out space that would allow us to humbly limit our doctrines and pass those beliefs on to our children. To understand the concept, you have to look at the fact that he's saying, you know, right now we live in a world that is kind of hostile to our views, and so maybe we have to live as exiles in our own country. Now, for those of you that grew up around Mennonite or Amish, you can recognize that. But the concept here really comes from the Catholic idea. Saint Benedict of Nursia founded the monasteries that helped preserve the remnants of the Western civilization. We have a lot of Western civilization today because he founded the monasteries. Matter of fact, the current pope, he's called Pope Benedict, and he traces his lineage back to Saint Benedict. And this was something that was just to try to preserve what happens. And there is a sense in which some of that might even be necessary. We have to preserve our Christian institutions. I think it's good that we have Prestonwood Christian Academy. I'm glad that we have programs for our children to take them sometimes out of the hostile culture and reinforce their values. But at the same time, this is, again, one more suggestion of withdrawal and retreat. But I want to keep this moving. So the second thing that we're running into is a lot of people said, okay, this is really too far gone. We've got to prepare for the apocalypse. And we heard Pastor Graham talking about the apocalypse. And if you look at your handout there, you'll notice that I give you a little bit of the history of some of these doomsayers. You're free to laugh during this section if you want. But nevertheless, I wanted to remind you that this has been something that has been part of our Western culture for some time. Let me go to AD 1000. As you might imagine, there was a lot of expectation of the apocalypse in AD 1000. Why? Because as we read last time in Revelation chapter 21, it talks about a 1,000-year reign. Misunderstanding what that meant, some thought that that meant that after the birth of Christ, which, by the way, they got wrong in terms of the date. But after the birth of Christ, there would be 1,000 years and then Christ would return. So there was a lot of millennial expectation in the year 1000. When 1000 came and went, some of them said, well, maybe we got the date wrong. And then finally, somebody thought, wait a minute, this will happen after Christ died. So then there was a lot of millennial expectation in AD 2033. But as we well know, Christ did not return then. But this was this kind of idea that this was going to be the clash of Armageddon. They had it all wrong. But nevertheless, that was kind of the belief that we were at the end of the age and there was going to be a great apocalypse. Then they came to realize that, no, the real apocalypse is going to come in 1666, because that took the 1,000-year reign of the millennium with the mark of the beast, 666. And so then they really were convinced that this is when the apocalypse would come. If you want to read some of the literature from that time, you can see that there were some really significant justifications for that. Some of the Muslim leaders that at that point were on the scene, what had happened after the Crusades, you could identify someone that could have looked a little bit like an Antichrist, and you can see how they might have come to the belief that 1666 was the year. But of course, it came and went as well. We've talked in this class before about some of these apocalyptic ideas in America. One of those were the Millerites. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. William Miller predicted that Christ would return on October 22, 1844. And this chart, if you look at it in more detail, and it's also in one of our other presentations, he counts up all the dates and everything. And there you can see why he would have some real belief in that. Well, in 1844, when Christ did not return, he recalculates, oh no, wait a minute, I guess maybe it's 1845. But eventually, almost half of the Millerite congregation, if you will, just simply walked away. But one of the individuals that walked away, a former Millerite, was a man by the name of Charles Taze Russell, who was the man who started what? The Jehovah's Witnesses. And if you have not followed this, the Jehovah's Witnesses have been the chronic date setters. The first one he set was at 1874, which did not happen. But then people that followed after him set a lot of dates. And for a while, we used to, even at Probe, because we'd written about this, have people denying that these were really prophecies. So we actually had a file that Pat Zuckerin and Don Clausen put together of some photocopies of these predictions. But one of the biggest predictions, they were convinced that Christ was going to return in 1914. When he did not, they said, well, he returned invisibly. Then there was another prediction in 1918, 1925, 1941, the most recent one, 1975. So far, we haven't seen any of those. But again, doomsday prophets certainly have, I think, sullied the reputation of people that speak on prophecy. I just ask Gary Fraser. Some people just probably roll their eyes when they say, oh, another prophecy guy, you know. And yet that, I think, is something blessing that is due to people that really do not necessarily have a good orthodox view. Okay, I had to put at least one astronomer in there for Parker, if nothing else. You might remember back in 1982, there were true astrophysicists who said that at that time we had this rare alignment of all nine of the planets, and this was called the Jupiter effect. And so the argument was is that all of a sudden you have Mars and Venus and Earth and Jupiter and Saturn all the way out to Neptune, and I think at that time we still considered Pluto a planet. But okay, they all line up, and they were convinced there are going to be all sorts of gravitational pull. It was going to have killer earthquakes and other phenomena, and did not happen. So sometimes not only the date setters are theologians, but sometimes they're even scientists. Which then brings us to some of the more famous ones more recently. You might remember Edgar Weisenot published a book, 88 Reasons Why the Rapture Is in 1988. And there was just a tremendous amount of belief in this. The one time we actually had somebody rush into Point of View and rush into the studio during a live program was one of the disciples of Edward Weisenot, which is why we learned to lock doors after that, because he wanted to let everybody know that the end was coming. Well, it didn't come in 1988, so Weisenot recalculated and predicted, I guess the rapture's going to come in 89. So he had 89 reasons for the rapture in 89, but nothing ever came of any of that as well. And so then we have Elizabeth Clare Prophet, who predicted that we would have a nuclear war that would start on April 23rd, 1990. And so many of them actually went into bunkers in Montana, and they would only come out occasionally to get food, and some of those people have just now left those bunkers. What is it? Oh, these years later, can you believe this? You know, that is just amazing to me. That were some of the followers. And then for those of us from California, we might remember this. Remember Heaven's Gate? Of course, you know, predicted that the Earth was going to be recycled, and so there was the prediction that the only way to escape this was to commit mass suicide, and then our souls would connect up to the Hale-Bopp comet. And so the police came in, and there were all these people dressed in these funny outfits, and they were all in these bunk beds, and they all had committed suicide, which is one of the sadder ones, obviously, of some of these doomsday prophets. And you have, of course, Edgar Cayce. If you've ever been to Virginia Beach, that's where you have all of the work of Edgar Cayce. He was known as the Sleeping Prophet, and really back in the 1930s predicted that the Battle of Armageddon would take place in 1999. He'd been dead for many years before this happened, so he's one of the few prophets not to have experienced the embarrassment of a prediction that did not take place. So now we come to the real cataclysm, and that happened in the year 2000, right? Y2K. Does everybody remember Y2K? People stockpiling everything from food to toilet paper to whatever. Anyway, I'm having fun with this to show you that there have been a lot of doomsday prophets. But in the midst of that, when you read the book of Revelation, read the book of Daniel, hear about prophecy, or somebody makes a prediction, you have a lot of people that are actually preparing for the apocalypse. If you haven't seen it, this is on National Geographic Channel, and it's a story of all these individuals that are doomsday preppers, and they are preparing for the doomsday, and it's something to really think about. The word obviously is derived from the word preparation, or its variation, preparedness, and typically the preppers are preparing for some kind of severe time in the future. Maybe they believe it's economic, so they may come at it from an economic point of view or political point of view. They may come at it from a theological point of view, but they're preparing for maybe a natural catastrophe or a disaster or something like that. Now, with that as background, does it make sense to maybe do something to store up something? A lot of preppers are maybe storing up some food, some water, some supplies. And, you know, this might make some sense, you know, if you lose power or hit by a tornado or an earthquake. If you look at that, you might want to have that much food, especially if you have a teenager in the house, right? You know, I mean, if that teenager brings over their friends, they could clear that out, and there would be nothing left in that cupboard. So there may be some value in having a little extra storage, though that makes some sense. This last year, we lost our power for almost 72 hours. Now, we could go elsewhere, but, you know, losing the power when it's cold and when the heat's not on, you know, there are some things to think about. And if there was a major disaster, we've seen what's happened with some floods. So a little of that might make some sense, you know. And some people even have what's called a bug-out bag, where they'll put some things together in case things in the town get worse and they need to leave. you know, and now I've seen people writing about bug-in bags as well. But I do believe that some maybe have gone a little bit overboard. This is a family with all the food and water and resources they've stored, and that's just one of the many preppers you can see. And if you haven't seen one of those, you know, watch it for National Geographic. And it just, you know, can you imagine all that? Where would you put all of that? Nothing else. But nevertheless, this is the family and the preparations they are making for the cataclysm that they believe is imminent. Now, what does the government say? Well, you know, if you go and look at FEMA right now, they give you some ideas to have just maybe some things. Well, I don't think it makes, it's overreaction to have flashlights and batteries or candles or some food or some things like that. This is what FEMA recommends, Red Cross. This is what they've suggested you might want to have on hand. So a little of that does indeed make some sense. And I think the bigger question we need to ask is, you know, what are we going to do from a biblical point of view? This book, The Disastrous Preparedness Manual, I like what it says. You know, my motto is prepare for what makes sense. Harsh weather, power outages, loss of income, stranded on the road. But we really just kind of have to ask ourselves from a biblical point of view, how do we think about it? And here's a couple of principles. First of all, Christians are not to have a spirit of fear. You know what I'm going to, but a spirit of sound mind. Put the not in there. I'll fix it for Parker. We'll fix it in the future. How did I miss that? I think it was in there, but when I changed it, I moved the not around somewhere. Anyway, we are not to have a spirit of fear, but a sound mind. But that'll help you remember, right? That's, you know, probably one of them. We're to rely, obviously, on God's providential guidance, both individually and collectively. We're to set our minds on the things above, but not on earth. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that we should neglect, you know, providing for our family and taking care of the circumstances that might take place. Matter of fact, the book of Proverbs tells us quite a bit about storing up wine and preparing for harsh circumstances. It says, go to the anthill, sluggard, and observe her way and be wise. So it seems to me that a little bit of preparedness is a good thing. But I like what C.S. Lewis says. This is a very long essay, and I apologize for taking a very long essay and putting it with two bullet points. But C.S. Lewis, in one of his pieces a while back, said that the curtain may ring down at any moment, say before you finish reading this paragraph. This seems to be, to some people, intolerably frustrating. Because he's pointing out what Pastor Graham was pointing out today, the imminent return of Jesus Christ. Imminency means that Christ could return before the end of our message this morning, or he could return 1,000 years from now. And some people say, well, I hope he returns later because, you know, I want to see my daughters get married. You know, I want to be able to retire. I want to get that new car and enjoy that. You know, there's a sense in which sometimes we say, wait a minute, that's really frustrating. You know, it's kind of hard to make plans because I never know what the future might hold. And that's the point he's making. We do not even know whether we're in Act 1 or in Act 5. Now, in light of what we're seeing, I think we all tend to believe that we're pretty close. You know, as some people have jokingly said, I'm not going to buy any green bananas here, you know, because, you know, things could happen real quickly, especially in light of all the things we're going to hear from Johnny Moore next week. When he gets up there, he will put the fear of God into you, I'll tell you. I mean, he will really cause you to reevaluate your priorities. But at the same time, we just really don't know. And so a person that does not know plans for the future, prepares for whatever the circumstances might be, and I think a wise and discerning Christian might indeed do that. There's another reason why I think we should do that. You know, we talked about this idea of being preppers, but there are at least two people that I have very high respect for. Robert Jeffries in his book, The Twilight's Last Gleaming, and Gary Fraser's book, America at the Tipping Point. And these two very godly individuals, both Southern Baptists, friends of this church, are both saying the same thing. If you look at the Bible, America's not in it. Now, I have some people try to tell me that, you know, there's the eagle, that's the America, or Babylon, that's America, or New York City, or whatever. No chance. So somewhere along the line, you got to wonder, is there a future for America? And the bottom line is probably not. And so some people have really wondered, well, what does that mean? Well, it means that someday America is not part of the prophetic scheme. And even apart from that, as Gary Fraser and both Robert Jeffers point out, $18 trillion of debt, you know, we keep expecting water to run uphill, and we keep expecting that the economic principles of supply and demand, of debt, don't have an impact. Someday they might. So I think there's some value in reevaluating that. And that's why some people have been very concerned about what's called Jade Helm. About 12 days ago, this particular military exercise unfolded, and it's an operation to actually train individuals what to do if indeed there is some kind of need for martial law, what to do if there's some kind of economic collapse. Now, interesting enough, one of the people that I have on my radio program from time to time is Louis Gohmert, who is a representative from the Tyler area and in the 1st District. And he points out something that kind of bothered him, because you have the country, or actually the states that pretend to be countries in the blue, and that's California, Nevada, and Colorado. Then you have some that are kind of somewhat neutral, and that's kind of like Arizona and New Mexico. And then you have the ones that are the hostile states, and those are Utah and Texas, which are both red states, and they're the enemy states. And he said, isn't it interesting that the two most red states in this area are the hostile enemy states? And he had some problems with that. But I think it illustrates something that we should pay attention to. Whether we like to believe it or not, the government seems to be planning for the possibility that what we've seen happening in Greece someday could happen here. It's going to happen tomorrow? Probably not. Could it happen someday? If we don't turn some things around, someday we'll find ourselves in a situation perhaps very much like that. And again, this is why I think a wise and discerning individual would look at this and say, maybe I need to make wise choices. Trust in God's provision, but also make wise decisions about that as well. Which brings me back to the third and final point before we'll open up for a question or two. What about political and cultural engagement? First of all, there's a possibility that some have raised about whether we might someday be forced into a situation of civil disobedience. You would hope not, but that's a possibility. Matt Barber wrote this piece here, and Matt Barber experienced it himself when he was fired from his job at a tech company simply because they found his blog, and he had actually in his blog defended traditional marriage, and that was enough for him to get fired. Of course, we've had Brandon Eich, who was the head of Mozilla, who was fired simply because he had given money to Proposition 8 in California. And so you see that that's a possibility that some people have talked about. And first of all, would we ever think about that? If we were ever commanded by government to do something which we believed would violate Scripture, would we ever disobey? And I think we have some biblical examples. We have the Hebrew midwives in Exodus 1 and 2, for example, where they said, well, you're supposed to kill these babies. They said, well, they just were delivered too quickly. We couldn't kill them. Of course, you have Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You're to bow down before Nebuchadnezzar. What do they say? We will not. And God can save us, but even if he does not, and they're thrown into the fiery furnace. You have, of course, then under King Darius, an edict of the Medes and the Persians that no one should pray. And Daniel said, I'm still going to pray. He's thrown in the lion's den. You have the apostles that are told in the New Testament, they are commanded not to go and to share their faith. And they say what? We will obey what? God rather than men. So are there some biblical examples? Certainly there are. Are there examples in American culture? Well, I think we have a few. The Boston Tea Party is a pretty good example about that. They were actually violating that in the act of civil disobedience. You have Henry David Thoreau, not necessarily using a biblical argument, but certainly a civil disobedience argument, where he went in prison because he said, I'm not going to allow my tax dollars to go to support slavery. And so he went to jail for that. You have the Underground Railroad because you had the Fugitive Slave Law. It says you have to return fugitive slaves. No, we're going to work underground to free as many slaves as we can, to free them from slavery. Of course, you have Martin Luther King Jr. And his writing. I'll get to that in just a minute. The pro-life movement. I mean, Martin Luther King Jr., a good example, a letter from the Birmingham Jail, one of the most important pieces of contemporary writing. I would encourage you to sit down and read that. And he is using a biblical justification for why we are not commanded to obey unjust, unbiblical laws. I mean, he uses a tremendous amount of theological explanation, given the fact that he was writing this on pieces of toilet paper and newspapers and everything. It's amazing what he was able to do to write that particular letter. So there are times when we might actually be called to exercise civil disobedience. If the government were to tell Jack Graham to marry a same-sex couple, do we all know what the answer would be? Yes. Even if they threatened our tax-exempt status, do you know what the answer would be? I think we know what the answer would be. Again, in my book, Christian Ethics in Plain Language, I have a whole chapter on it, so I'm not going to try to cover that today, but instead let some of you ask some questions. But there are five biblical principles for civil disobedience. Things like, if you are going to exercise civil disobedience, the law needs to be unjust and unbiblical. You can't exercise civil disobedience because you disagree with the law, you know, because you first of all can change it, which leads to another principle. There should be means of redress. And we do. But we obey laws, Romans 13, 1 to 7, unless there's a command which obeyed could cause us to disobey God. For example, and here's an example I like to use even in the private sector. You could work in a hospital that does abortions, and I think could do that with the idea that as a pro-life person, I'd want to change the policy. That would be very different than if you were working with a doctor who said, you have to perform this abortion with me or I will fire you. Then you have no choice. Do you see? So in other words, it's a direct and specific command which, if obeyed, would cause you to disobey the Bible and God. So anyway, those are some points to make. But if nothing else, I thought I'd end with a piece by Patrick Buchanan, because he really helped us understand what the battle is. Because he said, interesting enough, ultimately our culture war is about one question. Is God dead or is God king? He says, for centuries, this issue has been crucial. Because if God is dead, as Nietzsche wrote, everything is permissible. If there is no God, there are no absolutes, and everything's permissible. And eventually, one will logically reach the conclusion of the Paris student radicals of 1968, the only thing that is forbidden is to forbid. Does that sound like the world today? The only thing you can say is wrong is to say something is wrong. But, he goes on to say, if God is king, men have a duty to try as best they can to conform their lives to his will and shape society in accordance with his law. Defection and being indifferent are not options open to us. We are commanded to fight. So nothing else. We've, you know, certainly gone through this book of Revelation, and I'm wanting to maybe give some of us a chance to kind of think through how we're going to respond. And if you haven't thought about it until now, I'm hoping this starts the conversation, because we are living in a more hostile world. And we're going to have to think about how we do want to respond. All right. Parker, thank you.